Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Friday Roundtable. This hour, how the Trump administration's foreign policy is coalescing in the midst of controversy and crisis. The afterglow of President Trump's first overseas trip, generally thought to be successful, didn't last long as he returned to a crisis that's now enveloping his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Kushner is alleged to have met with Russia's ambassador before Trump was inaugurated to discuss setting up a secret back channel to Russia. He's certainly not the first member of the Trump team to be investigated for alleged collusion with the Russians, but he is the closest to the president. Today, why this Russia investigation may be so damaging and how it will affect the president's foreign policy and America's moral authority in the world. Mary Curtin is one of our roundtablers. She's the diplomat in residence at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Ahmed Samatar is a professor of international studies at McAllister College. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Nick Hayes is a professor of history and an expert on Russia at St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict. Welcome back, Nick. Good to have you here.
Always a pleasure, Carrie.
I want to ask you about the back channel. What is wrong with setting up a back channel, even if it was done before the administration was actually running the White House?
Well, in principle, there's nothing wrong, and it's quite common to set up back channels of diplomatic communication. It happens all the time. The difference is if you're meeting, well, there is another president in office, in this case, President Obama, and are discussing matters such as the sanctions against Russia, which were a matter of policy of the Obama administration, and doing that secretly. There might be an analogy to this to Nixon during the course of the 68 election in regard to back-channeling to Hanoi and Saigon in regard to alternate settlements to the Vietnam War. That one often comes up. But nevertheless, this is at best stretching the limits of what is acceptable in back-channel diplomacy.
Ahmed, would you say that back-channels have a potential of working in a way when just, you know, open and transparent diplomacy doesn't?
Well, before I respond to that, I want to take a point with your introduction.
Of course.
And that is, I don't think the visit was totally successful.
Oh, yes. Oh, we are going to get to that.
Yes,
no problem.
Partially, perhaps in maybe places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Yes, and we'll talk
like
about
that.
Why.
But in Europe, it was a disaster.
Got
in
it.
Fact. But the back channel, I think, problem, from my point of view, is not that it is done, but the fact that Mr. Kushner did not declare that he has done this as he was being, reviewed for, or he was filling the form, whatever the form is called, for becoming part of the establishment at the White House, that he has not declared that he has done this. And many people think that, that's a problem.
Do you, Mary, think it's a problem if it bears some fruit?
Well, I think, as the others have said, that back channels, side channels, informal channels are actually a longstanding part of diplomacy and have often borne fruit because conversations can be started in a way that's sort of off to the side. But I agree with the others. The way that if it is as reported, the way that this appears to have been done, including suggesting that it be handled through Russian communications equipment and systems, given Russia and given its long history of attempting to use people and create compromising information, and then not declaring it in your private, reporting form about your foreign contacts, it's those other things that are a problem, not the idea of informal contacts.
And since you were a diplomat and you're the diplomat in residence at the U of M, do you have a sense of what the diplomats who, and maybe they're not the ambassadors, but maybe they're the staff who do a very important work, may be feeling about kind of the way the Trump administration and he himself, the president himself, handles these communications with other countries?
I think that there is a general sense of deep concern about the impact of the way that he handles things, including the intemperate tweets that come out in the middle of the night, and the apparent lack of deep understanding of the nature of things like NATO or the complexity of the Middle East and even Shiite-Sunni, intra-Sunni relationships, and to wade into that without apparent deep information and understanding is very, very worrisome to professionals.
Beyond the fact that, I mean, he's doing a lot of things differently. There's no question about that. Does this go, if you share Mary's concern, does this go beyond, well, we're seeing a different kind of management of international affairs than we've seen for a long time? That doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong.
Well, it is.
Why?
It is. I think this president, unlike any other president, at least I have read about or I have witnessed in the 40 years I have been in the United States, is extremely incompetent. He doesn't know much about the world that he's dealing with. He doesn't even know much about the United States itself. So there's a problem of style and substance at the same time. And the coming together of substance and style, I think, are creating already barely 2-3 months major problems for this country in terms of leadership.
What's your first clue that what gives you, I should say, the greatest concern about maybe at this point the shallowness of his knowledge about the world?
Well, the first concern for me is style. We're just talking about the style of how do you approach other societies as you are beginning to transit into becoming president of the United States. So there is a style of boorishness, and it shows itself in the way he deals with American journalists, for example, in which he identifies them as the enemy of the people. I've never heard anything like that before. So there is a style problem, and then there is a substance problem of how to deliberately make decisions for the United States. And I think the visit to Europe, and I think also to the Middle East, partly manifested those the limitations of President Trump.
Let me dig in on that right after Nick speaks here.
Again, I'm a historian, and I happen to be a Russian historian. And there's a quote from Russian history that has haunted me over the last 2 weeks. At a critical moment in Russian history in October 1916, Russia had stumbled from one military bungle disaster to another, was crumbling down in the First World War. It was about to crash catastrophically in the Russian Revolution. An eminent politician, leader of the liberal movement, a famous professor, his name was Paul Milyukov, representative to what was called the Duma of the Parliament, stood up on the floor and he read off all of the incompetencies that the Tsarist administration had committed. But he had this refrain he kept coming back to. Is this stupidity or is it treason? Stupidity or treason? And I added up, and I'll just single one aspect of stupidity, if I may. If you look at the Russian connection, if you look at the behavior of Manafort or Carter Page, frankly, if you look at Kushner's behavior, they have naively and gladly walked into a KGB trap. It's obvious they were being kind of nurtured, courted. Just a few days ago now, there was a leak from Russian diplomatic sources that they believed they had enough leverage, enough what the Russians call compromise or compromising information on these characters to have leverage over them. And that, to me, shows it's not just incompetence, but perhaps not even aware that these are treasonous activities that they're engaged in.
And the danger of that, Mary, is if the Russians have leverage over somebody who is so close to the president, they can start to influence and shape the decisions that the president make.
And I think that there's a lot of feeling among diplomats and foreign policy observers that impact is already being felt. The goal of the Russians for a long time has been to weaken the strong alliance and the institutions that unite the United States to Western Europe, mm-hmm. most notably NATO, but right. also the EU. And we have just seen the first trip to Europe that was preceded by and characterized by and followed by intemperate tweets and comments that that have made our European allies start to say, well, you know, we need to think about going it. How are we going to manage this without them?
This is what Angela Merkel right. said and almost immediately after the trip. Mm-hmm. Right.
This is what Russia wants. Russia wants weakened unity in the West and – It seems that whether or not there was a direct line, we haven't seen that, to say, this is what we want you to do, that clearly there has been support for candidates that the Russians thought would achieve that goal.
And just to be obvious about this, the reason Russia wants a fraying in these alliances that the United States has with Western Europe is?
Well, the opposition to NATO, the expansion of NATO, has been the primary goal of Putin's foreign policy ever since he rose to power in the year 2000. Trump just inadvertently achieved what Putin couldn't do on his own. I think historians will remember this trip to Europe for Angela Merkel's speech, what she said at the end, that we may have to go it alone when you look at it in the larger sense. So, and the second part of it is, if you look at all of the issues of the alleged Russian connections and the election, Putin achieved exactly what he wanted, to make the elections look fraudulent, to create distrust, to create confusion. He got it. He got what he wanted. And so at least in this round, score one for Putin and zero for Trump.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think the demise of the Soviet Union, which was a major power in the global system, I think gave the Russians a sense that they would have to recalculate in the way in which they deal with the rest of the world, particularly powerful countries like the United States and the European Union, countries in Western Europe. And for them, therefore, my sense is that you don't want to go to war, but you want to do whatever you can, diplomatically, trade, other kinds of activities that are non-militaristic, to undermine the capacity of the United States to be the leader of the rest of the world, and to undermine, of course, the European Union. And in that sense, I think they are slowly succeeding, and they are succeeding particularly because of the incompetence, I think, maybe even more things, of the United States' current administration.
You mentioned a moment ago that for everyone who is saying this was a generally successful trip to Europe, your view was that it was a disaster. I'd like you to first listen to how Sean Spicer has characterized the trip, the first big trip overseas.
Just 4 months into this administration, and it shows how quickly and decisively the president is acting to strengthen alliances, to form new partnerships, and to rebuild America's standing in the world. We've never seen before at this point in a presidency such sweeping reassurance of American interest and the inauguration of a foreign policy strategy designed to bring back the world from growing dangers and perpetual disasters brought on by years of failed leadership.
What was the leadership? Well, insult your friends and push the prime minister of Montenegro aside.
I think if you are the royal family of Saudi Arabia, this was successful.
Because?
Because he acknowledged Saudi Arabia as a major power in the area.
There was no talk of human rights.
Exactly. But if you were a Saudi citizen, this was a very alienating. If you read the papers in Arabic, you can see this from the Gulf. For the populations, the Saudi regime is a country that's owned by a family. It is the definition of a dictatorship. The same thing with Egypt. Egypt is a dictatorship, military dictatorship, really.
Right.
Sisi is a military dictator.
And again, no mention of
rights
and support for the dictator.
That's right. And the pulse of the population of Egyptians is aghast with this. So if you are dealing then with a relationship between with the leaders of Egypt and Saudi Arabia, perhaps that was successful. If you are dealing with American relationship with the people of those countries, there's a major damage. And then, of course, Europe, the story now is very obvious.
And Mary and Nick, if you were a citizen of Europe, how do you see this?
Well, clearly, human rights is no longer a priority on the American agenda, that what she said explicitly. So that would be the first shift. The second shift is clearly cultivating European ties is not a priority with this administration.
I think I would agree with Nick, and I would also maybe go back to the Middle East portion of the trip. And I mentioned this before, that it was a great success, I think, for Saudi Arabia in having the U.S. line up so clearly with what Saudi Arabia wants. And that, I think, unnecessarily gets us into the Saudi Arabia versus Iran, which has sectarian elements, but also geopolitical elements. But also, it completely ignores the tension within the Sunni community of states in the Gulf in particular. Just the day after he was there, a dispute between Qatar and Saudi Arabia sort of came back on. There, those countries are also opposing each other, for example, in arming factions in Libya, that it was not a success for the United States.
I wanted to read an excerpt from in the New York Times written by the foreign minister of Iran, who wrote an op-ed about, of course, he comes to that obviously with an agenda and an opinion. They've just had an election, of course, in Iran. And Mr. Zarif wrote this about the arms deal with the Saudis that Trump tied up while he was there. At best, Mr. Trump is extorting our Saudi neighbors, milking them for money they do not have. At worst, he could be turning the U.S. into Saudi Arabia's mercenary in the Middle East, a rather ignominious position for America, considering where 15 of the September 11th hijackers came from. Ahmed, what do you think of that?
I think that's a very poignant statement. You don't have to love Iran to see some truth in that. The country that has been the place where the majority of the hijackers and the terrorists have come from. And that country has never paid any price for this. Iranians have never sent these kinds of terrorists to us, to the United States, but they have paid heavy price for being who they are. So I think you would agree to a significant extent what the Iranian foreign minister has written up.
So while we're talking about bonds and coalitions, Nick, did you see what's happening between Angela Merkel and the new president of France and some of these other European countries as kind of a realization of having to form their bonds more closely and think of America in a different way?
Oh, I think there's any question of that. The two of them signaled that immediately. The president of France now also moved to talk to Putin and to establish better relations with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that was a clear diplomatic message they were sending, that they'll get their house in order, and also assuming that Britain will not be part of this movement.
What does that mean long-term, do you think?
Well, long-term, you could argue something like this, in a long-term historical perspective. It perhaps was inevitable, and it had been happening already. It certainly was the case under the Bush administration that Great Britain was moving more and more to tightly align in military operations and political support for the United States. Well, if you go back to the Iraq War, the opposition in German public opinion and politics to the Iraq War got stronger and stronger. There was more tension with the Europeans. And we even had, Cheney used to talk, Rumsfeld used to talk about the old Europe. Mm-hmm. And we were going to ally with
Rumsfeld,
the new
Rumsfeld, I think, wasn't it?
Was
yeah.
it Rumsfeld?
Yeah, I think so.
But anyway, in other words, we don't need these old Germans and the French and so on and so forth. We're going to cultivate the Slovaks or our Romanian and Bulgarian allies, something to that effect. Excuse me for speaking patronizingly. But so this kind of deprecation of the classical core ties with the European continent had been in the works for a long time. In the case of Trump, it seems to me that he did not think this through. Even the details of what blaming NATO for not, in effect, paying its dues, which was a misrepresentation of what was owed in the financing of NATO operations. And I also read it as him keeping one of his campaign promises. And we can look over to the issue of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Well, one of the great achievements of Obama was at least to enter into negotiations and obtain some kind of cooperation and deal with Iran. Well, Trump, being the anti-Obama candidate on anything, moves directly to Saudi Arabia as if he's totally disregarding the connection to the Iranians.
One of the interesting observations, I think, was the fact that Obama, in fact, was in Germany.
Yes.
Very close to the time. And the relationship not only between Obama and Merkel, the chancellor, but also between Obama and the people of Germany was quite interesting. How dichotomously different it is, the relationship with our current president, by the way, whose family is from Germany. You know, his
That's
grandfather
right.
from Germany,
and he's married to someone who grew up in Europe.
That's right. That's right. But I think the biggest worry for Well, I think most Americans, I would argue, and for the rest of the world, I just got back from London about a week ago, is the deep relationship, as Nick said, between Western European democracies and the United States. It's very deep, as much as deep it could be. For that now to get scuttled like this and to be undermined like this is very worrisome for many people in Western Europe.
So, Mary, if President Trump says, well, if their bonds are tighter, meaning Western Europe, then maybe they'll take on more of their own defense and their more responsibility, and the United States can turn inward. I mean, this is the argument he made during the campaign.
Right.
We can focus more on solving some of the problems that we have, and maybe it's time for Europe to do that. What's wrong with that kind of an argument?
Well, you know, I think that there have been discussions for decades, at least since the end of the Cold War, about NATO and the purpose of NATO, the levels of spending. These are not new conversations. And so there is nothing wrong with having a conversation about that. But to do it, frankly, in a boorish way, as has been said, is undermines relationships that are important to a world order that's not perfect, but has served the United States, mm-hmm. frankly, quite well.
But I mean, are you saying you're really talking more about the style of his interactions and not the substance of
them? I think there's a combination of style and substance. So our relationship with our European allies has never been perfect. And the relationship between NATO and the EU, which interestingly Putin sees as sort of two sides of the same coin as part of the sphere of influence of the West, that also has never been perfect. I would say one danger in terms of our having this tight relationship with these longstanding allies is that, you know, there's always been some talk, especially from the French, of an EU mm-hmm. sort of security or military force.
Yeah.
And the United States has always seen that as competition for dollars, but also interoperability with NATO, and has never liked that.
Or independence of policymaking.
Right. Independence of policymaking, interoperability, dependability in the event of the need for an Article 5 operation or any other operation.
That's right.
And so both the substance of threatening, you know, not reaffirming commitment to Article 5 and threatening, you know, all these different things pulling back in, undermine the strength of those institutions that, with all their imperfections, have served us well.
But there's another issue.
And create, I think, this further churning. So I'm one of those people that does think there's always room for discussion of these.
Yeah.
So it's both the substance and the style.
But there's also the question about the expenditures on NATO. I mean, the NATO countries in Europe are now coming very close to meeting the standard of expenditures that the president has been talking about. I think they are going to meet. Some of them have met it. They are meeting within the coming 2 years. I was reading last night in the London Guardian reporting on this. But the other side also of the story is that the alliance and the loyalty of the European countries to the United States, even when we get into some treacherous foreign policy adventures,
mm-hmm.
is really quite good. I mean, they are fighting there. They were with us in Afghanistan from day one. They are still there. And in Iraq and in that Middle Eastern zone. So I think this fits well into this current president's inability to read the text and the evidence very carefully, and then make decisions and presentations accordingly.
Nick, let me ask it this way, because you've all expressed great concern about the way the president is using his power and authority on the international stage. What if he was more polished, smoother, but he still felt and believed the things that he said? I think, you know, the countries ought to pay more for their own defense. I mean, are we in some ways being distracted by what you've all said is a boorish way to handle these things and not paying more attention to what he really wants to do?
Well, in this case, and for the record, I've said this before, Trump can be right about some things.
Yeah.
And at least he raised the question of rethinking NATO, at least in the course of the campaign. I happen to think an obsolete alliance, at least in terms of the way it was configured and the way it operates today.
So you agree with him in part?
In a small part. I think we need a conversation on this. I feel very strongly that the expansion eastward of NATO was misguided and should be reconsidered. I think this our nation should have had in the election an open public discussion of this and what is the future of NATO. I happen to agree with a number of scholars and policy analysts who have said something like that we should perhaps give a notice that in 10 years we will withdraw from this alliance and rejoin some other alliance or operating system within Europe. It's not for the United States to withdraw from Europe, but to find a better post-Cold War alliance system or cooperative system for dealing with these affairs. You ask a personal question because so much of it is about the personality of this man. I cannot help but think world leaders have to be aware that this is a guy who couldn't figure out why we can't use nuclear weapons if we have them, for example, he arrives in Tel Aviv and he says he just left the Middle East. Did somebody show him a map?
But we're still on style here.
Well, it is more than style.
It's ignorance.
It's this in-your-face ignorance. Yeah. I mean, there's a different... if you ask, could he improve his style? It does not seem likely that this man is going to reform his personality.
No, I'm not asking could he improve his style. I think what we see is what we get.
The concept of the adjective of obsolescence of NATO, I think, is exaggerated. I think one can make an argument for reforming certain things in NATO. Yeah, and I agree with Nick. This expansion into Eastern Europe, I think, was foolhardy. But I think at the core, NATO is an important block in the sustainability of a world order that has kept us away from a third world war.
So when Nick says, over the course of time, withdraw from NATO the way it's set up and look for a new alliance, you say to that?
Well, it might be adventurous, but I think I could see the possibility of that, which would mean then it will push the European countries and the European Union to reimagine their own security and rebuild their own capacity. And they have the resources. I mean, the European Union is the largest economy in the world, uh-huh. The European Union. So they have that capacity. They have the technology. They have the manpower. They have the resources if they can go to it. And in that sense, it might push them, therefore, to upgrade their own collective security.
And I think that this does go back to style. If we could have a reasoned conversation about the future of our relationship across the board with Europe, including on the security side, that might lead to a stronger EU security force. But to have it happen out of anger at the United States is not a good way to do it, because I think it does weaken those bonds. But could I also say something else on style, which I think we saw in Saudi Arabia, but also vis-a-vis China, is that President Trump seems incredibly susceptible to flattery. What we saw when he was in Saudi Arabia and what seems to have been very successful on the part of the Chinese prime minister, it to me is almost as shocking as the bluster and the boorishness.
You're seeing world leaders
figure this out and use it. And in the meantime, and we haven't even mentioned China yet,
right?
In the meantime, China is not even very quietly going about building its outreach, not just in Asia, but in Africa and Latin America, through its investments and loans and, you know, the way that it operates.
Mary, hold the thought on China. Let me say this. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We'll come back and talk about that. This is a Friday Roundtable that takes note of President Trump's return from his 9-day overseas trip, something that the White House is characterizing as a big success. You're hearing different views from our roundtablers. Nick Hayes is with us. He's a professor of history and an expert on Russia at St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict. Ahmed Samatar, professor of international studies at McAllister College, and Mary Curtin is the diplomat in residence at the University of Minnesota. We'll continue our conversation. We are going to talk about China. I also want to talk about what America First means to our roundtablers and this idea of moral authority, the United States' moral authority in the world, and then anything else that they want to bring up as well. That's all on the other side of news.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Environmental campaigners staged protests today against President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. In Berlin, Greenpeace activists projected Trump's silhouette onto the side of the U.S. embassy, along with the words, hashtag total loser so sad. Vice President Mike Pence says Trump's decision is refreshing and will lead to U.S. jobs. A top European Union official says the EU and China believe President Trump made a mistake by pulling out of the climate agreement. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ridiculed allegations of Russian meddling in U.S. elections, accusing the Democrats of trying to shift blame for their defeat and likening the accusations against Russia to anti-Semitism. Facing questions from NBC's Megyn Kelly, Putin said the claims of Russian interference in the U.S. election contained nothing concrete, only assumptions. Authorities say at least 8 protesters are dead and 4 police are injured as hundreds of people demonstrate in Kabul for better security in the Afghan capital. More than 1,000 people were taking part in the demonstration today in the wake of a powerful truck bomb that killed 90 people on Wednesday. In the UK, Prince William has met with police officers who responded to the suicide bombing in Manchester, offering gratitude for the help of those first on the scene of the May 22nd attack. 22 people were killed in the Manchester attack. And U.S. employers pulled back on hiring in May by adding only 138,000 jobs through hiring. And hiring was still enough, though, to help nudge the unemployment rate down. The rate fell to 4.3%. That's the lowest level since 2001. Still, the rate declined mainly for a less than encouraging reason. People stopped looking for work and so were no longer counted as unemployed. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:40.
74 Seconds is the new podcast from NPR News. It's our look into the shooting death of Philando Castile and the trial of St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez. Subscribe now to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts. NPR News. Discover what matters.
I'm Mike Mulcahy. It was a long, drawn-out end to the legislative session, and it may not be over yet. Join me at 11 Friday for a conversation with Governor Mark Dayton about why he vetoed money for the House and Senate and what might happen next.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by Target. Since 1946, Target has given 5% of its profits to communities, which today equals millions of dollars a week. More information at target.com/community.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about President Trump's 9-day trip overseas and some of the issues that he's confronting in the White House and the views of our roundtablers about how different countries and different leaders are seeing the United States. Ahmed Samatar with us here from McAllister. Nick Hayes with us from St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict. And Mary Curtin with us, diplomat in residence at the University of Minnesota. Mary, before we went to news, you were talking about China. I think we need to spend a bit of time talking about that. We could devote a whole roundtable to that. You are concerned about what China is doing in different parts of the world where they have not previously been highly influential. Is that right? Or how they're building their influence.
And what I would say is that in the campaign, Donald Trump talked a lot about China and talked about how tough he was going
yes.
to be. And
don't all presidential candidates
do
that?
They
though?
Do, Republican and Democrat, and they talk about different angles of how they're going to be tough on China. So that's not a new theme. The single note that he struck, I think, on trade and the way he was going to handle it was probably farther out than others. And what we've seen instead is that he seems to have succumbed, I think, to the flattery of the Chinese premier during his visit here. And we haven't seen really very much about China or China policy in the meantime, except that the United States withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was intended as a way to bring together our trade partners. And in part, it was whether, and you can argue whether that's good or not, in part, it was sort of to strengthen our trade with them vis-a-vis China. China was not part of that. So we have pulled out of the trade, the TPP, and in the meantime, some of those countries have gotten together to see whether they can move that forward, and they have had trade meetings with China. And in the meantime, China is going ahead with a regional project that they call One Belt, One Road, which connects the countries all around that region to strengthen China's trade relationships. China's investing heavily throughout Latin America, which they never were before, Africa, which they have been for a long time.
Their policies seem pretty wise, don't they, in the vacuum that seems to be developing here?
They seem to have moved very steadily, and not to mention their military expanding presence in the South China Sea.
Well, the Chinese are much more sophisticated than we thought, and in fact than we are. I was speaking to a number of people in the State Department, retirees from the State Department, and their alienation from what's going on in terms of intelligent, internationalist, American interest, of course, driven foreign policy has now taken a back seat to whatever is happening in the White House, which nobody knows, and no direction to this. And I think what is happening is that a certain kind of an American parochialism has now captured the White House, and it shows in the staffing of the White House. It shows to a certain extent what's happening to the State Department, from the Secretary of State, who is really almost missing in action, to the hollowing out of the State Department itself and the professional people who have spent a lifetime studying the world regionally and otherwise. But the Chinese have been slowly building their capacity to understand the world and then penetrate the world. In Africa, they are now the country in Africa in terms of investment and presence, from building energy systems
infrastructure,
to infrastructure,
right?
billions and billions of dollars investments in this. So the challenge for the United States, whether these 4 years would have created such a deficit for us in terms of our understanding and action in international relations, so much so that by the time a new president comes in 4 years or 8 years, God forbid, perhaps, then I think we might find that the Chinese now are way ahead in the way they have built their infrastructure into the global system.
Can the Chinese do that much in 4 years, Nick?
Well, I mean, first of all, you comment on the alliance that didn't happen. And this goes back to the Obama administration. Putin made a big deal about increased cooperation, made multi-billion-dollar oil and gas contracts for development in Siberia with the Chinese, and this was much touted, and this was going to be his answer to the sanctions of Europe, that he would move into the Asian market. They had a stronger partner with China. China very deftly, you know, signed the agreements, but nothing ever came of it. This may, in fact, explain the fact that there is no real Chinese connection, why Putin suddenly turned his strategy to concentrate on American elections or European elections or things of that sort.
Let's go back to Rex Tillerson. I do want to talk about the Secretary of State. Ahmed, you said he's missing in action. Mm-hmm. Mary, you said you're trying to figure out what game he's playing. Mm-hmm. What game do you think? Is it a game? He seems to be under the radar and likes it that way.
So what I feel that I do not know is, does he not understand what a Secretary of State could do and the power that a Secretary of State could have through both public and private diplomacy? He doesn't seem to be out there and being very active in being the person who is the primary point of contact with our allies and our enemies. You know, that the Secretary of State always, of course, takes direction. The president ultimately decides, but the Secretary of State is the person who is the primary interface with the rest of the world. He does not like to speak to the public. He lets others set the tone and set the public discourse, including letting Russians do that. Clearly now purposefully leaves American journalists out of that, out of any, you know, out of press conferences, and has not even nominated senior level appointees, which means that you have the many thousand, you know, Foreign Service officers and professionals at the mid and almost senior levels in place doing their work, but there is no senior level presidential appointees who are the leadership of the organization, and every organization needs leadership. And so the State Department is even more marginalized than it had been before.
Or could it be that he understands that people who try to compete with the president in camera time and attention end up really being pushed aside and in trouble? I mean, Ahmed, is that possible?
Well, it might be, but I don't think that's really that important. I think what is important, and I agree, is that I think he's like the president in the sense that he might have been and probably was a very experienced businessman.
He was the CEO of a major oil company, Exxon, right?
But that's different than engaging complex economic, diplomatic, military, other kinds of cultural relationships with the rest of the world, which I think the State Department is the point institution for us.
So you're saying he doesn't really know how to
do
this
job? He doesn't have
the
equipment. I don't think he has the intellectual equipment and the experience to be the kind of a Secretary of State that we need at this particular juncture. In that sense, he's like the president, that he is equally also ignorant.
The learning curve
about the rest of the world.
Right.
And at the same time, he seems to be incapable of surrounding himself and bringing into the fore highly experienced professional people. The State Department for a long time has been the envy, I think, of the rest of the world in terms of professionalism. Mm-hmm. But today, the State Department seems to be sidelined. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, American diplomatic relations with the rest of the world is suffering.
Mary?
And from what I hear from friends that are still at the State Department, is that they don't know what is happening. They are, in fact, being left out of even simple meetings with foreign officials. And sometimes even Tillerson is left out of meetings with foreign officials at the White House. And so I guess when I say what is his game is, my question is, does he not understand what the role of the State Department is and can be and the role it can play? Or is he deliberately part of an effort to undermine people who they do not trust because of their internationalism and their professionalism, frankly?
Nick, a thought?
Well, first of all, a thought. I share Ahmed's comments. And initially, I thought Tillerson was going to be like the grown-up in the room. I mean, I had high expectations of him.
Because he'd run a big multinational.
Yes, and given the nature of the business contacts he had had, the oil and gas contacts, for example, with the Russians, this takes a great deal of diplomatic skill, I would assume. I just assumed more from him. And I've been completely confused as by his low profile. The one exception is he was the heavy hitter on the Russia question. That is, he had the meeting with Lavrov.
Right.
He came out and reinstated all of these more traditional anti-Russian opinions. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say how to read that because the president, once again, was basically silent on the Russian issue at that time.
The person who seems to be a bit more traditional in terms of projecting American international relations is our ambassador at the United Nations.
Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley.
Yes.
And sometimes she, in fact, contradicted the president of the United
and
States
oddly,
intentionally.
President Trump seems to permit that.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is
surprising. But the ambassador of the UN still is somewhat marginal compared to the Secretary of State, who is really the boss of American foreign policy next to the president of the United States. And there is a vacuum here, and there is a worry, therefore, on the part of the international community of who to deal with. This is the most important country in the world, the United States, and everybody wants to deal with that country, obviously. But who to deal with, and intelligently, that's the major problem for us.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable discussing President Trump's trip overseas and a lot of the complicated international situations and relationships that this White House is in the midst of and kind of taking note of some of the relationships he has and doesn't have with world leaders as well. What do you think, Nick, when you hear President Trump say things like, I think making peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians is a lot easier than people think?
I think it's from the same guy who said, who would have believed healthcare policy was so complicated? I mean, it expresses, if you forgive me, to me, the same kind of naivete and lack of historical background and real lack of any basis in the policies themselves.
You said in our brief break that it is worth noting that there are places in other countries where President Trump is fairly popular. Where are those places?
Russia.
Okay.
And, you know, we've read about this, but it is a genuine feeling. And among the Russian population. They like his everything we dislike about him. They like this kind of brash style. His political incorrectness. They like that. They believe he's speaking with. There's a certain authenticity. They believe in his language. They like
all
of this.
Well, that's what some American voters like.
And what's
him
interesting
too.
About it, Carrie, is really since February, public opinion in Russia has split on this, because the elite regime, the media outlets, and that were very pro-Trump until February, when there were a few statements about not moving on sanctions, a few statements about not yielding on the Crimea or Ukraine. And for the most part, the official organs are frequently getting a little critical, or certainly they've turned down the praise of Trump.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me, number one, they did a media survey in February for the Kremlin did and found out that stories on Trump were getting more airtime than stories on Putin. That may explain it very simply.
Okay.
But it does tell me that they've realized, number one, this guy can't deliver. Number two, Russians like stability. Mm-hmm. They cannot see a long-term relationship. And as my observation is, it also shows that Russian society in a way is fracturing like American society is. That Trump has this core popular base of support where, I don't know, should we put ourselves in the category of elites? But let us say, the press, the pundits and so forth are obviously very critical of him.
Yeah, but democracy is also partly about grace and the relationship between people who live in the same place and how they deal with each other. It's not just about electoral politics where you vote for someone. Mm-hmm. It's of how you conduct mm-hmm. yourself in your civic relationship with other citizens and maybe other people in other parts of the world that you want them to deal with you in the same way. And I think Trump's popularity is some segment. I don't think it is ever the great majority of the American people. And he was not elected by the great majority of the American people. In fact, he lost by 3 million votes. But in Europe.
In the popular vote.
In the popular
yes.
vote, yeah. But in Europe, I think there is it has been a dormant right wing for a long time, but has been in the soil in Europe, whether it's in Germany mm-hmm. or whether it is in France or whether it is Le Pen in France or even UKIP in England and in Britain. And, of course, in the United States. I think the challenge is for what I would call the vast majority, the real silent now vast majority of the people in the United States and in Europe, to rise against the kind of the contamination of democracy as a cultural, not only as a economic and political or way of managing society, but human relationships with each other. That's what democracy is also precious about. And I think this regime in the United States under Trump is beginning to damage that gracefulness of democratic politics and degenerate it to the level in which a particular kind of rhetoric now has become common in the United States.
You've reminded me that the last time that we talked about international affairs on a roundtable, we were talking about these candidates, these right-wing nationalistic mm-hmm. candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had some evidence now that it wasn't successful in the Netherlands. Yeah. It wasn't successful in France in the end.
And it's dwindling in Germany.
Exactly. So, I mean, maybe the great concern about, Europe leaning more towards these nationalistic candidates didn't need to be as widespread as it was. Mary, what are your thoughts?
Or maybe the concern helped energize the people yes. who wanted to stop it. And I think that, I think the concern and I think vigilance about that problem are important, because even though, say, Marine Le Pen did not win, she gained a substantial number of voters in France.
And she still leads the party.
And she still leads the party,
right.
And she is still there. Geert Wilders' party is still present
in the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And you see those parties scattered around Europe. They are still there. I do think that, I hope that maybe a tide is turning, but I don't think it's time to say, oh, we shouldn't have worried about that in the first place.
I might jump in to say it probably is also anti-Trump sentiment, the reaction to Trump's mm-hmm. election in the United States that galvanized the movements that turned the tides. I think we've dabbled, talked about this and about personality, the lack of grace. I can't help but think we just celebrated the 100th anniversary of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's mm-hmm. birth. Trump would have been what, in first year of high school, second year of high school, when Kennedy said, the torch is passed to a new generation. prepared to pay any price, to bear any burden in defense of liberty. The tremendous idealism and inspiration he brought to American politics, for the life of me, he should have been that generation. I cannot figure out how the man was politically formed.
But I think also it is important in our own country not to be too, to despair too much over Trump. This is the country that elected Obama twice and with very significant majorities. And it is very possible that there is a second wind in that kind of a community. And many people argue that Clinton lost the elections. Not Trump did not win. She lost the elections because she was unable to articulate a vision that will capture the imagination of that coalition that Obama built over those two elections. So the future is not necessarily with Trump, I think.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.